Welcome to the Plant a Trillion Trees podcast. I'm Eva Monheim.
And I'm Hal Rosner. We are both certified arborists through the International Society of Arboriculture. The purpose of our podcast is to encourage tree planting and proper tree care for our urban forests, which include neighborhoods, parks, and other open spaces.
We will also cover a myriad of tree topics, including the important role trees play in relationship to the climate crisis. Thank you for joining us. We'd like to thank our sponsor, Monheim Microphones. Monheim Microphones designs and handcrafts top-tier studio microphones and preamps right here in the United States in Hollywood, California. Their incredible line of innovative microphones and designs are used around the world by everyone from podcasters to top-charting record producers and singers. They recently released their new royalty microphone, Monheim Microphones Unparalleled Excellence, monheimmicrophones.com.
Verdant Earth Educators provides dynamic in-person training and online learning opportunities for environmental and horticultural businesses. Owned by ISA-certified arborists and former university faculty, the Verdant Earth Educator team provides consultations on tree care and recommends climate-resilient opportunities for your valued green spaces. Verdant Earth Educators is all about seeding knowledge for success. Find Verdant Earth Educators at verdanteartheducators.com.
This podcast is being recorded on October 13th, 2023. Stephen Kiskela is the crop and growing team manager at Arbutus Grove Nursery, located at the southern tip of Vancouver Island, British Columbia, Canada. Each year, his team grows 15 million container seedlings composed of 18 or more species, primarily for reforestation throughout Western Canada and the Pacific Northwest. He has been involved in reforestation his entire career, from collecting seeds to organizing and monitoring tree planting programs, although his primary focus has been growing seedlings at various nurseries throughout British Columbia. While employed as a seedling reforestation specialist, he advised nurseries and tree seed orchards on growing practices. In this role, he also guided foresters and other planting trees on seedling stock type selection and planting practices and established numerous outplanting trials to search for answers in overcoming reforestation challenges. One of his favorite tree growing sayings is, "Growing trees is not rocket science, it's much harder." He has a Master of Science degree in Forest Biology from the University of Victoria, a Bachelor of Science in Agriculture, Horticulture major from the University of Guelph, and a Horticulture diploma from Olds College. Welcome to the Plant a Trillion Trees podcast, Stephen. We're delighted you could be with us today.
Thanks, Eva.
So we want to hear a little bit about you, Stephen, and how you found your way to the nursery industry. We'd like to hear a little bit also about Arbutus Nursery and your employer and the great work that they're doing. But tell us how you found your way to growing seedlings in horticulture and nursery work.
Sure, I'd be happy to. Growing up, I always enjoyed being outdoors and in nature, and that led me to a summer job after high school at the local garden center, Green Thumb. From that point on, I guess you could say I was hooked, and I decided I wanted to pursue a career working with plants. So I decided to study horticulture, first getting a diploma and then a degree, and later actually doing some continuing education to get a forestry designation. So I spent a lot of my youth in the incredible forest of Vancouver Island, which gave me the idea toward the end of my degree that I could combine my horticulture education with forestry by growing forest seedlings. And back at the time, I also remember thinking that growing trees would be doing something good for the environment, something you could feel good about. And I guess I was one of the lucky ones who was able to find out what I was passionate about at an early age and do it for a living. Not every day is sun and roses, of course, but some days I'm still amazed I get paid to do what I do. So I lucked out into it and have been happily doing it ever since. I've worked at a few nurseries over my career. Arbutus Grove Nursery is a family-owned operated business. It started roughly 40 years ago. Hans Stoffel Sma came from Holland and started out with one greenhouse. That was right when BC was privatizing nurseries and expanding the nursery base. So he started with one, growing hemlock, I believe. And that would have been maybe a couple hundred thousand. And today we're up to about 15 million seedlings, 18 different species planted all over BC and on the coast interior and a lot of the Pacific Northwest US down into Washington, Oregon.
Stephen, could we zero in a little bit on where exactly you grew up? I'm curious about that.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I grew up in Nanaimo, British Columbia, which is 30 kilometers, which is say 20 miles from Vancouver. So 20 miles of water, just on the east coast of Vancouver Island, close to the 49th parallel. Southern Canada, I guess. And it's quite a unique area as well as far as Canada goes. It's the, I guess, Victoria, a couple hundred kilometers or south is a bit warmer, but it's one of the mildest areas of Canada. And it's in one of the most unique biogeoclimatic zones, the coastal Douglas fir. That's quite a rare zone with the big Douglas fir and arbutus trees and cedar.
It's a beautiful area. I've been up there and I just think it's very dreamy. That's the word I can use for it. At the very beginning, we have a saying that you utilized, you know, it's not a rocket scientist, it's much harder. And I love that saying because everyone thinks that it's so easy to grow trees. And it is, it's like a like fine tuning an instrument. That's how I view it because I've done a lot of propagation myself. And I think that it's, you know, you have to make sure that the seedlings are just right. It's almost as if you are a midwife getting everything prepared to come forth and fill that void within the forest with these young seedlings. And I just think it is more difficult than, and I'm not a rocket scientist, but I also know that it doesn't always work. Even though you have everything down pat and you can have a formulaic approach to things, it doesn't always work. And so my question to you is, yeah, how do you handle that? And what is your approach when you run against some issues that may be larger than life, literally and figuratively?
Yeah, Eva, those are great analogies. And, you know, the rocket science quote that growing trees isn't rocket science, it's much harder. Rocket science, I'm not a rocket scientist either, but there's a lot of math and things are finite and you can actually get an exact answer. With trees and biology and all things biological, there's so much variability and endless permutations and possibilities of what can happen that we can't control, that every year is different. So how do we control things? I guess, first of all, I'd say all growers, if you're going to be a nursery grower, you got to be optimistic. I know.
Yes.
We're always
very true.
Always very optimistic people. You know, you talked about plans. We do have, you know, there's a set of plans we have that we, you know, obviously we know what the plan is for this crop and when we're, and not all the trees, but a lot of the trees in BC start out in greenhouses. We grow some in outdoor compounds. So we're in a controlled environment. So we can control the temperature and control the humidity somewhat and control the lights and of course control the irrigation. So we have some control there, but every year, you know, I think in my career, it's, you're always learning something every year. And what's nice with growing a large amount of trees is that, you know, you might have 95% or even 98% or whatever that are really good, or, you know, that seems to be an exaggeration, but you'll have a whole bunch that are really good. You're always going to have a couple problem lots. And luckily, you're not growing only one species, because if that one turns out to be your problem lot, I'm always thinking about when we have a problem lot. And I know most growers were always, okay, what did we do? Why did we try to, you know, figure out, we have after the fact, we you know, we do postmortems. We try to figure out the ones where we can figure out the problem and what caused it. They're easier to fix. But usually we always have a game plan. Okay, next year, we're going to sow this crop earlier. We're going to turn the lights off sooner. You know, we're going to spray with fungicide or we're, you know, there's always a plan. So how do you deal with it? I guess the one nice thing as well is, you know, growing trees is a form of farming. We're always, every year you start again. You know, of course, for us, the big thing is, you know, we have to be upfront with our customers right away and let them know there is a problem because we're growing trees. And how we look at it is success, a successful seedling is actually one that's going to perform well in the forest. It's not just so getting a free-growing tree and establishing a plantation. That's our actual end goal, judge of success.
Yeah, and I think that's so true. You know, you can have a seed crop and they may not be all even. They may not come up all at the same time. You may have some patchy areas, as you mentioned, because the seed might have hit a little heat spell somewhere in the location where, but do you go back to the same tree areas all the time for seed? Like some of our former guests have told us that they have mother trees that they go to on a regular basis. Do you have a stream of mother trees that you follow, or how does that work?
British Columbia is a little bit different, and the whole reforestation industry in BC is quite advanced. You know, we started first planting trees back in 1930 with bare root, and then containers started in 1970s with a styroblock, which we've been growing in 50 years. So at this point now, 70% of the trees planted in BC of the roughly 300 million every year are from are genetically improved from seed orchards. So there's been a lot of work. So we still collect about 30% of the seeds. So like you said, there is certain areas that seed collectors will go back to. But yeah, but 70% are genetically improved. And I just want to make it clear because some people get, I don't want to work people up. It's not genetically modified. Like there's no modification of the genes. Like we don't have fish genes in there. So it's just classical tree breeding, the same as our apples and the vegetables. So
it's like the tomato, as I always think of the tomato is, you know, you get the seeds from the tomato and you find the best plant and then you take the seeds from that tomato because it's bigger, it's sweeter, and it's just year after year. So the more you do it, in case our listeners are not aware of it, the more somebody does something in the industry, the more you become familiar. And you have to have a really close familiarity with the trees and you have to have an understanding of that. So I guess from a very early age, you've been very observant of your surroundings and the types of trees that you're dealing with now, you've had a very close connection with. Is that pretty much the case?
Oh, yeah. No, I think that's one of the, you know, growers, I think you have to, yeah, you notice little things. And I guess I like sayings. There's another saying, the best fertilizer on any farm is provided by the farmer's footsteps. You know, we have to.
I like that one. Wow, you're poetic.
There's, you know, we use a lot of technology, and we had one summer student a couple of years ago. I like what she said to me. She said, "Hey, this." She was, you know, quite young, and she was her first sort of exposure to growing trees. She goes, "This is just like farming with science." Although I know they do a lot of obviously science and farming nowadays too. But yeah, it's being very observant, and no matter how much computer controls we have and everything, you know, just going out there and observing the little things. And maybe that's part of what, you know, they say some people have a green thumb. There's been a lot of science done on plants and trees, and we know the physiology and know why things are happening, but growing them and getting, like you said, you know, it's hard to grow a tree. I think I would say anyone can grow a tree, but it's hard to grow a good tree. You know, there's a difference, right? You can grow tall, skinny trees with poor roots and small diameter, but to grow, you know, the right size, not too tall, thick stem, good roots, it can be very tough. And you know, I said we're growing 18 species now, and even within each species, we have different provenances, which, you know, some from high up in the mountains, some from low, some from the coast, some from the interior. So they all grow a little bit differently. So like you said, being intimate, some of these seed lots we will grow year after year. So we know how they react. And that's, you know, when you said, what do you do? So sometimes we have a seed lot that's more vigorous or not as vigorous. So we can track that. And the next year we go, oh, okay, this one was a slow grower. We better sow that one sooner.
That makes a lot of sense.
So you're growing in multiple regions in Canada, and when you have the finished product, are they getting shipped out to specific locations based on your client's request? Or perhaps I'm sounding naive, or does the final product kind of get mixed and sent out, I don't want to say haphazardly, but are you growing with a specific client in mind?
Oh yeah, that's a great question, Hal. So I think I talked brush on this a little bit. So in BC, it's a law you have to replant. And we have what we call chief forester standards for seed. And within there, because in BC, it's 95% public land for the forest in BC, and then the forestry takes place mainly on that. So what happens is pretty well most of the nurseries that are growing these large amounts of trees, it's all contracts. So what happens is there's some, I guess we call it spec trees, or where there's no owner, but all the orders we have, a forest company or government, a landowner will say, hey, I'd like 100,000 Doug fir for this area, this elevation and this. And so we have these chief forester standards. There's very specific areas where the seed has to come from, or in the orchard for this area. So, and now we've moved into climate-based seed transfer rules, basically a form of assisted migration due to climate change. And basically all the seed is moving from south to north. So that's why we're actually having to get some seed lots from the US, because we are, our Canadian border stops at the 49th parallel, of course. And then trees are going up, the seed is going up the mountains as well, the higher elevations. So basically when we have an order in, the company knows where they're going to plant it and is for a specific customer already. So there's not a lot of, you know, it's not like going to your normal garden center and just picking up, you know, some trees. Yeah. One thing I just wanted to say as well, I know that some regions are having a problem with seed supply because yes. We have these orchards. We developed an orchard. I was talking with our head person at the seed center. We have a provincial seed center. Again, it's because it's all provincial land. We've had this big seed center that is definitely world. I'd like to give them a shout out. They're definitely world class. And we have about 22 species, and there's 71,000 kilograms. So that's about probably 150,000 pounds, enough seed to grow 7.5 billion trees we have in storage right now. So we don't have a seed supply. That's enough for about 25 years if we kept at our current rate. Now, that said, there is some areas, you know, there's always some pockets, some geoclimatic zones where maybe we're a bit short. And that's would be some of the areas where maybe we're collecting seed. But we basically, we don't have a problem with seed.
Yeah. Can I ask if for some reason, if there's a tree within your context that might be found somewhere else, and obviously the provenance is not the same, but the species is the same. For example, crossing over the Bering Strait, I'm using that as an example, in a place on the other side of the Bering Strait where they need critical seed. Is that something that your organization would do? And I'm thinking like in a catastrophic event where you might need to share seed or sell seed or however way you do it. Is that something that you would do?
So like, would we sell seed? So yeah. I think we do. Yeah. The, you know, some of the forest companies, they have their own seed orchards and they will sell seed when they have excess to meet their needs. And I think the government will sell some sometimes. So yeah, there is some for sale, but I mean, I don't want to, that's not my area so much. I know, right. But I know there is seed sale. Yeah.
I was just wondering if that happens, because I'm kind of thinking of the, what is it, Svalbard vault, the vault in, is it Iceland, where they have the vault for edible foods, the seed for edible foods, large crops. I was thinking of something like that. I mean, we don't really have anything like that, except for maybe Wakehurst in England has forest seed, but really no other place. And I wonder, you know, having seed sit for too long also is not a great thing. So, you know, how do you distribute it?
In reference to your question there, I know seed, Douglas fir and Sitka spruce has been grown, I think, in the UK. You know, there's sometimes that gets shipped. And the seed that is dried in the seed center, and they have these big freezers that it's stored at minus 18 Celsius. Which, sorry, I don't have my Fahrenheit converter here, but minus 18. And some seeds will really last a long time. We find like the Western Red Cedar, that after 5 years starts to deteriorate. So, you know, certain species won't last as long, but the majority. And actually last year we had an interior Douglas fir seed lot that was 60 years old.
Wow.
It was incredible.
Wow.
Older than myself. And it was like, wow. You know, and we produced a good crop of trees from it. So it was quite...
So having old seed like that actually introduces old genetics.
Exactly, yeah.
So you have a different genetic line there. that might happen from that.
Yeah.
Wow. I'm like excited about hearing all of this information because it makes me happy to know that there's somebody watching over the seed.
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess, you know, we've been lucky that, you know, we have this system in BC. And I think it's because BC is probably itself is like the size of a small country and, you know, and the amount of trees planted every year. So because it was all public land, so it became centralized. And there was a period, not so much now, but in the 80s and 90s, which is, I know for some people, that's a long, long time ago, there was a lot of research and the government put a lot of money towards all this. And I would say now, you know, the reforestation industry in BC, like I haven't been to Sweden or Scandinavia. People often talk about, you know, how they're the best. I mean, I think I would put my money on that we stack up to them and we're, you know, but I think a lot of people don't know that about BC. And a lot of what when people think of forestry in BC, I think they think about roadblocks and logging, right? They don't know the successful part of how many trees and we've reforested. So we've planted in BC roughly 9 billion trees to date. And survival has been very high. Survival has been incredibly high, like it was up in the 80s, 90s. And so we have enough capacity to meet our needs now. And I told you with the seed and with the nurseries. But what has been happening, and of course, everyone's aware in the last few years with climate change, we've had the mountain pine beetle epidemic and then the fires coming in and climate change. So the mountain pine beetle epidemic has caused, in some cases, it caused the fires to be a lot more severe because there's more woody debris out there. So then, of course, you know that more severe fires, they burn the seed source and they just, you know, burning up a lot of the organic matter. So it's much harder to reforest some of these areas. And as well, the system in BC, I guess why it has worked so well, part of it is the cost of reforesting is taken from the revenue derived from logging. So when you get money for the wood, part of that stumpage fee is used to plant the trees. And the companies have to, like legally, they have to reforest, not just plant, they're actually measured and they have to be what we call free growing, where they go back and after 10, 20 years, then the trees have to be above healthy and above the brush so that they're going to live. So that's been working really fine. And there was always a few fires every year. And, you know, some of the fires, especially lodgepole pine, would regenerate naturally. And the government had a small program to plant some of these areas. But now, like this year, we've had the amount of fires we've had is double our biggest ever fire year. We had 41 million acres burn. I mean, some of it's still burning. And that's double what our last record year was in 1995. So obviously, you know, we're all aware down in the U.S., I guess you're getting some of our smoke, unfortunately, from our fires.
And we've got a lot of your smoke. And like Hal and I talk about it all the time, that we have had fabulous guests from British Columbia because of your urban forestry school. And you know, I know that urban forestry is different than regular forestry, but more and more they're crossing over. And I know that when I was working with the tree tenders, we were getting foresters working with us. And they were like, this is so foreign to us, you know, working with the urban forest.
Right.
It's just so different. But if you have a good trained group of people, you can pivot much easier when there's issues. And I think that really is a kudos to British Columbia for what they've been doing.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of crossover there. And yes.
One thing I wanted to ask, Stephen, is you mentioned a very impressive success rate, about 80, 90%. What do you attribute that to?
I guess the initial part is because there was a lot of research done, like, and we had seedling specialists by the government and a lot of follow-up going out to the forest and seeing how the trees were doing. And part of this as well is it was in the forest company's best interest. Now, I said the money comes from the logging, but they, like any private enterprise, you know, they want to do a good job, but they don't want to spend more than necessary, right? So when I say it's coming from the forestry, I don't want to give the impression that there's just oodles of money. You spend as much as you want. So, you know, the more they spend, the less they get back. The money's there to cover it, but they want to be competitive and they don't want to waste money. They want to. So there was a big incentive for the forest companies to, you know, have good survival. So they were really looking at what's working and survival as well. I think it's partly as well because the way we grow them, this, you know, growing 300 million trees a year in BC, 25% are planted in the summer or the fall And the other, the majority, 75% are planted in the spring. So they're frozen stored. And all these seedlings, there's certain specifications. So they have to meet a certain quality. So normally there'll be a height specification, a minimum height, as well a maximum height, because we don't want really tall, the height versus the stem diameter ratio. If that gets a little wonky, then the trees don't do as well in the forest, and even brush will knock them over. So there's diameter, stem diameter ratios, and as well there's root. You know, it's got to be an extractable plug, have solid roots. And that one's a bit harder. Like, we don't normally do a dry weight or measure, but it's got to be extractable. And the other thing we do is that before all these spring trees are planted, before we store them, we do a frost hardiness test to make sure they're ready for storage. And we also, before they're planted in the spring, we take out samples and we do root growth potential tests. We'll take some up, we'll pot them up, put them in ideal condition in a growth chamber or greenhouse, grow them for 2 weeks, and then we make sure they have a certain amount of roots. And if they don't, we'll double check, you know, we'll do more tests to make sure there wasn't something wrong with the test. But this ensures that we're not planting trees that there, you know, something happened to them, they were dead when they were packaged or they got damaged in cold storage. So that is, I think there's just all these checks along the way. And I think as well, because we plant trees that are fairly good size, that it takes time to grow a good tree. Like, you can't, you know, it's photosynthesis, it's growth. You can't, you know, I think we're approaching, there's always things we can do, I imagine, to be better. But, you know, we're approaching some of the biological limits, I think, with how we grow these trees. Like, there's some trees planted in summer, I said July 1st. So those will be started in January. So it's basically 6 months they'll be planting a tree. And then the other trees are planted, they're started maybe in, most of them maybe in the end of February, March, April, May, and then they're harvested in October and frozen stored. So it takes that time for them to grow a really good solid root system, you know, to grow lots of branches. Like I said, we don't want just a tall skinny tree. We want lots of branches so you get a lot of photosynthetic apparatus so they can keep growing. We want a good solid root structure, but not root bound. And we also want a thick stem. And the thickness of the stem has been correlated with, or there's been research showing that it relates to how well they survive in the forest. And other things as well, you know, we try to nutrient load the seedlings before they go in the forest. We don't want to send them out deficient. You have to, we lower the fertilizer when we're getting them to set a bud. But after that, we can add more fertilizer a bit and just make sure that it's been found that nutrients move around in the trees. So if you have a tree that's has adequate nutrients, it'll do better than one that's sort of deficient when it goes up.
Do you have to worry about precipitation, or is that kind of a given in your region?
That's a good question, Hal, and that's been a problem. Yes, I talked about the fires. That's the other problem we've been having in the last few years is, unlike what we've ever had, we've been having extreme droughts that's even killing some of the mature western red cedar, say, on the coast of Vancouver Island. So there's been a lot of mortality. So those higher survival numbers, if we had the average from last year, the last 5 years, it's I'm sure it's no longer up in those 80s, 90s anymore. I was talking to one forester, we had the heat dome in 2021. You know, they planted 1 million trees and they went back a month later and they were all dead. You know, just...
Oh my gosh, that's horrible.
So it's really a thing, you know, we're looking at, and there's been research done, we're looking at planting maybe deeper containers to get the roots down into where there's moisture, looking at alternate planting times, maybe trying to grow trees with, you know, bigger roots, thicker stem, but not a big shoot, you know, and a small bud on top so it can get established. So yeah, it's precipitation is, it's a problem.
Now, when you plant your seeds, do you plant more than one per container, or do you do one in each container and allow empty locules?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. Like, because seed, obviously, we all know it's valuable, very valuable resource. And especially some of the seed from the seed orchard is, you know, it's expensive. And sometimes the seed is just scarce. We don't have a lot. So we always want to conserve as much as we can. So the sowing lines in the BC nurseries, they're vacuum seeders, where it's a drum, picks up a seed, or more than one, drops it off as it goes over the cavity. So in BC, we're using styro blocks, which can have anywhere. It's a modular system. The styro blocks are always 1 foot by 2 feet, but the depth can be smaller or lower. And the number of cavities will be anywhere from, could be 240 up to 45. No nurseries are at this point using a single sew. We use what we call fractional sewing, where we might put 1.5 seeds per cavity. 100% of the cavities will have one seed and 50% will have two seeds, right? So we do various fractions from, you know, 1.5, 1.67, 1.9. So we know how much seed, and this, and how we determine what the fraction is, it's based on the germination percent and sowing rules. So all the seed before we sow it, is it undergoes a germination test. So then there's probability tables on what's the probability that you will get a full cavity with that germination percent. And then we use the sowing rules to tell us how many to put per cavity. What we do though is we still, our machines are at this point, we're, you know, we're always looking, maybe trying to get some more advanced type sewing machine. It's not perfect. I'd say it's more of a coarse machine. So there is some empties. But what we often have people that a person will be stamped behind the sewing line, and on the big seed, they can move it around if there is any empties. But what we also do, what a lot of nurseries do, and not every nursery does this, but depends. If it's grown outdoors, they might leave more empty cavities. When our trees are grown in greenhouses, greenhouse space is expensive, you know, and basically as a, you're buying square foot of greenhouse space when you buy trees, basically. So what we do is, when we have doubles, we take them and we transplant them into the empties. So the idea is to use just enough seed so you've got enough to fill all your empties and not too much. But we still do, some of them will get wasted. Yeah.
That's interesting, because we were interviewing someone down here, and they don't put more than one seed per cell, because they figured out that it's easier to have empty cells and replant them to be pulling out seedlings. So it's, you know, I think it's all that is trial and error and testing, and it's a lot. And every organization's going to try as much as they can. And I'm wondering, is there an enclave or group of growers that get together and discuss the strategies of how you are growing and share what's successful with others and maybe talk about the incapabilities that you have and how you can actually improve those so that everybody's successful at the same rate that your companies are? Because if seed is that, it's like gold, really. If you have golden seed, you know, you don't want to be losing it on the table.
Yep. So, yeah, exactly. You know, there is every year there's nursery meetings. There's one in BC, the Forest Nursery Association of BC, and there's a Western Nursery and Conservation Nursery Association. And there was just a conference in Portland in the last week in September. So there is a lot of, you know, the research and stuff gets talked there. And there is some grower meetings. There's one in Washington, Olympia, held by, you know, by the government. So the U.S. government has a seeding research division sort of, or extension. So there is meetings there. I guess you have to imagine that these nurseries are still competing against each other, you know. So some nurseries will have maybe groups they talk to, and you know, there's a big nursery group in BC that owns, you know, there's some companies own multiple nurseries, and of course they'll talk together. But it's
proprietary.
I would say it's not,
some of it's
a little bit. Some of that, right?
No, it's
you know, it's sort of, I guess. I mean, you know, and especially though, but the seed center, that's the government thing, that, you know, every couple of years, they'll have a big meeting and get together, all the growers come and we talk about ways to do that. So it's certainly happening. But there, yeah, I mean, I can't, you know, I have to be truthful. There is some, you know, some nurseries have their secrets, I guess. Yeah.
We talked at the outset, Stephen, about assisted migration. And I also want to make sure we talk a little bit more about the fires that Canada has experienced this past summer. But with assisted migration, what kind of information is pulled together for the strategies necessary to plant seedling X on mountaintop Y? In other words, it seems like there must be multiple variables that go into those types of decisions.
Yeah, and that's a complex complex field. We have in BC, because we have these seed orchards, and they're a combination of private companies and government together. So we have breeders for a lot of different species. There's a pine breeder, a Douglas fir breeder. And so they work on a lot of this. And, you know, I think a good person to have on your podcast would be Greg O'Neill. He's a specialist in this, and he's given many, many talks on this area. And he's one of the people involved. But the BC government spent a lot of time and money over the last, I'm not sure how long, 10, 20 years that they've been working on this. And they introduced this climate-based seed transfer models. So we have a web-based system where you can go in and pick out where you're going to plant trees, what species.
Okay.
And it'll show you what seed lots can be used in that area and other jurisdictions as well. But we've mapped, and this happened a long time before, I guess, we started thinking about assisted migration, is that we mapped the province and put into all these different biogeoclimatic zones where, you know, I think there's 11 in the province, could be wrong. Like there's the coastal western hemlock, the, you know, montane spruce. So all these, so, you know, and within there they have the variants. So that's sort of how they're deciding now where seed can be planted.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, that's a great answer, and that clarifies what I was looking for.
Okay.
And that also ties in with Alaska when we had Jeff Lowenfeld on, remember? He was talking about that.
Yeah, the data and technology has to really be the major voice in guiding you, and it sounds like database, software, and otherwise, those systems are in place.
One thing I should say I forgot to mention is that with all this assisted migration, they've set up trials, I think all the way from Alaska down into maybe southern U.S., maybe Mexico, you know, different, like interior Doug fir has a huge range. So they've collected seeds from all the different areas and then planted it at all these different sites. So they've got maybe, you know, Doug fir from northern BC planted down to Mexico and Mexico up in northern BC. So they just planted stuff all around, you know, and they're gaining a lot of data from that as well.
Gotcha.
Boy, that's fabulous.
So in terms of the insect and disease pressure, you mentioned mountain pine beetle. Are there other things that foresters are up against that they have to control perhaps on a larger scale?
The mountain pine beetle, that's a big one, a huge one. And there's a spruce beetle now. And it seems like with climate change and you know, the droughts and the warmer temperatures, warmer winters not killing some bugs. Like my understanding is the mountain pine beetle has always been endemic to BC. There's always been small amounts, but just all the warm winters, not getting to minus 40 Fahrenheit anymore up north, you know, the pine beetle a lot more would survive, along with the way North America has evolved, where we suppress forest fires because we wanted to use the wood instead of let it burn. So that just let it build up. But that sort of moved through because it's killed most of the pine in BC. And it has resulted in the harvesting is in the interior where there's lodgepole pine is decreased substantially. It is going to decrease for the next 60 years. So it's a huge, huge hit. So with this warmer temperatures, there's spruce beetles coming up. There's some other beetles attacking Douglas fir, and drought, I think, is the big is another big issue, of course, as I mentioned. And there's always getting trees established. There's always some browse on some species. So there's always different products out there. The latest one now is the sheep fat trico. Foresters are trying. Before it was the pig's blood. I think it was pig and sheep blood. And that no one liked to use that one. Sort of, but we're moving on to this new product.
Right.
Just
to play devil's advocate, I suppose, to a certain extent, what's wrong with genetically modifying Douglas fir or some kind of spruce so that it has a innate resistance to a beetle or a boar? Why do people get so upset about that possibility?
Well, Hal, that's like you're asking me to talk about religion or politics.
Both are traps.
You know, I mean, I guess you could say the same about food. You know, why don't some people want to, I mean, myself, I have no problem eating genetically modified food. Some people don't. So with trees, I guess what the issue is, or what people are concerned about, is that we're putting monocultures out there. So, you know, something could, you know, a disease or a pest could come in and wipe them out a lot easier. As well, the maybe they're going to somehow have some effect on the environment that people don't know about, right? I think that's a concern. You know, we do actually, you know, when I say that, there was yellow cedar or yellow cypress, I guess. It's, you know, from Alaska down the coast. Yeah. There's not a lot of that, but we grow some. And it's really hard. We haven't able to successfully have seed orchards for that yet. And seed supply is really hard to get for that species. So we do actually rely on, and it's one species that we can take cuttings from, rooted cuttings. So basically, we are planting clones. We have some seed, and then maybe half is from cuttings every year. And they do have regulations with that. I think, you know, there's different families. So even when we select, we call it a veg lot, it's made up of maybe 50 different families. So it's not just one clone that, all the cuttings will be from one. It could be made up of, I don't know exact number, but off of my head, but something like 20 to 50 different families making up a veg lot.
You know, we grow Cupressus nucatensis here, which is the yellow. Mm-hmm. We grow it here on the East Coast. And it's a beautiful tree. It's a beautiful tree. Mm-hmm. But I want to go back to something you had said that, you know, we're talking about these large infestations. And if it was always there, what happened to the predator? Did they move further north? Did they disappear? Did something happen to them that they're not in great numbers anymore that can control that population of beetle? That's what kind of things that I start to think about. Like, it's an entire system. So, you know, where's that predator? And, you know, you have deer browse, and yeah, sure, we have deer grazing everywhere around here. And we have more deer in the next county than any place else in the U.S. But the idea of that predator, and is anybody tracking where the predators are going with climate change? Because plants are moving, are predators moving too and causing issues like these mass populations of insects?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. You know, I haven't really thought about that so much. I do know that I guess one of the big reasons I think in what we could call the predator of the mountain pine beetle, why it expanded so much or grew so much, was because of the lack of the cold winters. And I think that's what used to keep them in check. That, well, the two things, the cold winters would kill off a lot of them. And so they just never, you know, that was what I would call a predator, I guess, right, was the cold winter and then climate change. So it's gone. And the other thing is just the fact that because we were suppressing fires, there was a lot more older, mature pine on the landscape that was susceptible to mountain pine beetle. So those two things, you know, combined together. So, and with other species, I mean, and I'm sure you probably had people talk about invasive species as a huge issue. And you know, with our forestry and that, we have broom out here. That's a huge problem.
Yeah.
You know, that's, yeah. Even where I live on Southern Vancouver Island here, we have a European wall lizard.
Yeah.
Someone had a zoo and let them go and now they're starting to, they're all over the place.
It's like the boas in Florida.
I imagine.
Yeah, right. There was another thought that came across my mind. Is anybody working with the ornithologists to see if there's a shift in patterning of migration? Because that's something I always think about too. You know, are they moving further inland when they come up, or are they, you know, going further out closer to the east, or are they stopping and maybe not coming all the way up? And maybe that's also another reason why insects are in greater number, because I know I've seen sparrows eating Japanese beetles now, and they're not native. So the idea of, you know, that kind of thing is something I would think about too. And I know we don't have all the answers, but I'm kind of playing devil's advocate here and bringing out some questions that maybe you can answer, but maybe we need to think about.
Yeah, that's something to think about, and I'll say I can't answer that one. But I will. One thing I will say is it's maybe good to point out about, because some of your listeners might not know about BC forestry. BC forestry, it's a large land. It's a large landmass, very big. And we have relatively few people here. I think we have now? Maybe 3.5, 4, maybe 5 million. I'm sorry, I should be up on that. But anyways, we have relatively few people, and they're all clustered down on the 49th parallel for the most part. That's where, you know, Vancouver is, in the lower mainland, is huge. In Vancouver Island, we have we have relatively unpopulated areas. So we had all these forests, and being the west of North America, it was settled last. And we have these large forests. And the way forestry is done in BC, because a lot of people talk about plantation forestry with a negative context, you know, saying that, but the way forestry in BC is done, we don't use a lot of herbicides, less and less now. And there'll be logging. And, you know, you hear the term deforestation as well, but my understanding of deforestation is when you've actually wrecked the soil and you can't grow things again. So logging will take place, and then as quick as possible, because they know they're going to log. So they're already ordering the seeds. Like it takes, right now people are putting in orders for trees, but so what do we, fall 2023, if they want to plant, they're putting orders now for seedlings to be planted in the spring of 2025. It just takes that long, right? So they're putting them in advance. They know the area. And that's why it's a bit harder with the fires, because they come up and you don't know where you're going to plant. So they plant as soon as they can to try to get the trees in before the brush. But when they plant, they don't plant in rows. You know, the stumps are out there.
Right.
They have patches. So it's a very, you know, when you walk in these forests, it's not like rows and rows. It's not like a cornfield. They're very, you know, they leave coarse woody debris, and they don't leave riparian areas. So I guess I'm trying to say with your wildlife question, there still is a lot of, and they have to leave certain big trees over a certain diameter. So there is a lot of wildlife that still can use. I mean, obviously when you log, you get different.
Sure.
Animals come in, yeah. But it's different than just like a monoculture plantation.
Like a cornmeal. Well, see, we have a lot of those here in the U.S. We have a lot of monoculture. I mean, maybe less now since Suzanne Smard came on board with her book and talked about how important it is to leave certain other trees in place if you're going to be logging, so that there is some kind of mycorrhiza connection, which I think is important. And which I was going to ask you, when you make your soil mixes to plant your seed, do you inject mycorrhiza materials in with your seed mixes?
Yeah, I did just want to say that I do think there is a place for this plantation forestry as well in some cases, because I think in some places, if you can grow a lot, you know, quickly, and maybe where the climate is quicker, maybe in Georgia where things grow so quick, you're displacing maybe logging native forests. So, and I think they do more of that in New Zealand and Australia. They have certain areas.
We don't want to villainize it. Right.
No, that's what I'm saying. Yeah.
Yeah.
In case someone, I get a nasty phone call later on.
No, I understand what you're saying. And I get that too. Because there's a balance.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's a balance.
There's a balance. Yeah. So, mycorrhiza. So I've been involved in some trials with that, and we have trialed that, but it's not done in BC. If we're doing reclamation, like a mine site or an oil reclamation, they'll use it. If it's maybe, or else a marginal farmland that's being afforested. What we found is that often the mycorrhiza, like, and we'll get natural mycorrhiza to sort of blow in, and it's growing on our trees. But what we found was some of this mycorrhiza that we would get from a company, well, a couple of things. First of all, they only had like, you know, a couple strains. If you were really going to do that, the best thing, you would go to near the planting site, pick up some duff, put in a blender, put it on your trees. So we get one strain for spruce, but it's a huge area. So is this mycorrhiza adapted to this site? Mm-hmm. The other thing is, but the planting site is usually fairly low in nutrients. So in the nursery, because we're trying to get a big tree quickly, you know, we use a lot of nutrients. So often this mycorrhiza that's for out in the field doesn't grow so well in the nursery. And the other thing is, as well, like I said, they plant fairly quickly. So there still is some mycorrhiza living on the site. And it seems like it hasn't been shown a big benefit. But okay, you know, we're always looking to try new things. Yeah.
It's very much like the farmers down in, Apopka, I think, down in that region of Florida, where the tractor is pulling out the carrots while the lettuce is coming, being planted. The ground is so expensive to lose within the day while that's being pulled out. The next crop's already being put in. It's just unbelievable. And I can understand that with trees too. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. And they do it a lot because we can't use as much herbicides in Canada. And if you wait too long, then all the fireweed in the brush is getting a good hold. So it makes big sense to try to get it planted.
Right.
With the fires this past summer, how soon can those sites be replanted? Do you have a sense of that?
Yeah. So, I mean, the sites this summer, so I mean, some of them are still burning, obviously. So, but like I said, there is a lead time. So normally what they'll be doing is they'll go and survey and they'll find out, you know, which seed source and what they want to plant. If there was a fire earlier and they had time, usually the quickest that it could be planted would be a year and a half. Like if someone had a fire back in May or June and they're able to go survey it sort of now and get some idea of what stock they'd need, they could put their orders in like right now, September, October, the orders are in. And then most likely it'd be a spring plant. So it would be planted in the spring of 2025. So it's almost, yeah, 1.5, 2 years. That would be the earliest. Often it, you know, there'll be another year or so. Sometimes because of with the burns, it's different than logging. You know, it's they have to secure funding. Who's paying for it, right? So the government does pay for some of that. So then things are just a little bit slower.
One thing I should have asked early on is the trees that we're talking about in BC for forests, are they primarily a range of forest products, but perhaps don't include pulpwood, or is pulpwood grown in BC as well?
We do have pulp mills in BC. Primarily, we don't grow stands for pulpwood. It's a byproduct. It would be some of the, you know, the trees that are too small or, you know, on a stand that get harvested. So I think maybe eucalyptus plantations or other where they grow them quickly, and that we were not really, there was some experiments growing, I believe, cottonwood down in the Fraser River in those areas where I think Scott Paper, they were, you know, going to have these fast growing cottonwood plantations for pulpwood, but primarily it's a byproduct of, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. And when I looked through your planting list, I noticed red alder, and I wanted to ask, tell us about red alder, but also do you grow any other deciduous trees?
Yeah, there's not a lot of deciduous planted, but we do some. We grow some red alder, and actually I believe we have a seed orchard for red alder, so we have one improved seed lot.
And how's that used?
So that will be used there. We did have a company in BC, and I'm not sure if they're operating more, but they were trying to make a go of it, harvesting red alder. And it's used probably, as you know, for furniture and that kind of thing.
Okay.
It's quite a good wood. So they were actually planting, trying to have some plantations of that. But alder now is often used on, there's some sites that, you know, are, I guess you'd say, alder sites where they're finding it hard to get conifers growing as well. It could be some riparian areas or some rehabilitation. So there's not really a lot of pure stands of it planted that I know of. I mean, you could also have an area where there was a root disease affecting, say, Douglas fir that it wasn't growing, so they would put alder in there.
Okay.
We grow other deciduous, not a lot. I mean, right now at the nursery, we're growing some big leaf maple. We grow just a small amount of birch, and there's been a little bit of cottonwood planted as well, but that's,
gotcha.
Yeah, very minor.
So we've talked about a lot of stuff, and I really appreciate your expertise and wisdom. Can you tell us what your favorite tree is?
Yeah, I knew this question was coming. And, you know, I thought about it the last month. I really like trees. I like, you know, so it's hard for me to pick a favorite, but I'm going to say Coastal Douglas fir, Pseudotsuga menziei, variety menziesii, because it's my favorite tree to grow. And it's very vigorous, but yet very temperamental. It can be a challenge. And I love walking my dogs. There's a 120-year-old second growth Doug fir behind my house, and I take my dogs for a walk in there. So that would be my favorite, I guess.
We'll one take of my it. That's a good one.
Yeah, that's a yeah, really good you. One. Because we're losing ours here, right, Hal? I mean,
yeah, they're going away.
They're actually standing there skeletal of needle drop, bagworm. It's just so hot here. It just can't handle it, especially during the summer times. It's just really, it used to be one of our favorite Christmas trees, but not anymore. By the time you bring it into the house, all the needles are on the ground. So.
Oh,
it's crazy.
Yeah. We need to plant more trees.
Absolutely. And this has been such a delight. We were looking forward to talking with you about BC and what you're doing up there. And I know Hal and I always have conversations as to how impressed we are with what BC is doing for the world, really, for forestry.
Well, the Canadians are just so cool. That's what it all comes down to.
Right.
No. I'll admit it. Well,
I know. I don't want to brag, but I think BC is you know, one of the leaders in reforestation. But, you know, it's all a team effort. And, yeah, you guys are doing a lot of good things there, too. Everyone is. Yeah.
Well, thanks for joining us.
Yes, thank you so much. Take care.
Take care, Steve.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
The Plant a Trillion Trees podcast is edited by Andromeda Recordings in Hollywood, California.
Thank you.